You need a Bible. We're continuing our way through John's Gospel. Today we're going to be studying John chapter 8 from verse 12. Church Bibles, that's on page 757. John chapter 8 from verse 12, page 757. I invite you to pray with me. Now, Father, help us to be still and to listen carefully to the words of this Gospel. Transform us so that we understand these words, and especially that we see Jesus more clearly. Enable us and put in us the desire to respond in obedience, and we ask for Jesus' sake. Amen. Last Monday night, SBS showed a repeat of a documentary entitled Who's Your Daddy? The blurb for the documentary goes like this, quote, "In 1972, a study was conducted in the UK that claimed 30% non-paternity, which means one in three children were not biologically related to the man they call dad. Could this really be true? This program conducts the first ever purpose-designed paternity poll, asking some truly awkward questions." Unquote. I didn't watch the program, but I did check what they claimed as a result of their study. They found, not surprisingly, that the figure of 30% was completely bogus. They claim that the real figure is probably closer to 1%, which I guess I still find a bit shocking. Some commentators on John's Gospel have suggested that here in John chapter 8, there's a subtle indication that some people in Jesus' day raised questions about Jesus' own paternity. And given what John asserts about the nature of Jesus' paternity, perhaps we shouldn't be surprised if some people did. Whether or not such a subtle indication can be found here, John's Gospel has already raised the issue of the relationship between Jesus and his Father back in chapter 1. Remember that back in chapter 1, verse 49, Nathanael, one of Jesus' disciples, said to him, "You are the Son of God." Here in chapter 8, when Jesus' opponents raise the issue of genealogy, Jesus takes the opportunity to explain more forcefully than ever before how his relationship with his Father determines everything he says and does. So I've called today, "Like Father, Like Son," and the rest of what I'm going to say is about how chapter 8 applies that to Jesus and to his opponents. The whole of chapter 8 works out this theme, but I'm going to pick out just three aspects for a closer look. We'll see how Jesus is like his Father, A, in that he is the light of the world, B, in that he is the truth that sets people free, and three, in his very identity. And along the way, we'll look at how Jesus argues that his opponents are like their Father. I'm going to lead into part A with just teensy bit of orientation so we're clear where we are in the story of John's Gospel. In a number of ways, chapter 8 follows a similar pattern to chapter 6 that we worked through 2 weeks ago. Back in chapter 6, there's a festival about to happen, the Passover, and Jesus has a very large crowd of followers. Over the course of chapter 6, he teaches his followers in more depth about himself and his mission, and this leads to conflict with the religious leaders. And chapter 6 ends with many, perhaps most of Jesus' followers, abandoning him. Here in chapter 8, there's a festival underway. This time it's the Feast of Tabernacles. That's where we were with Jesus last week in chapter 7, and we're still there. Jesus' teaching has attracted some followers. Then he goes into more depth with his teaching, and there's a conflict. And this time the chapter ends with people picking up stones to try to kill Jesus. There are some other similarities between the two chapters. Chapter 6 has the first of the I am sayings. I am the bread of life. Chapter 6 has the second. I am the light of the world. Both the Passover and the Feast of Tabernacles recall the exodus from Egypt, and they look forward to a second exodus that would finally liberate the nation of Israel from subjugation to imperial powers, Rome being only the latest in a long series that spanned back over more than 700 years. key thing you need to know for today about the Feast of Tabernacles is that at nighttime there was a very famous ceremony in which a number of oil lamps in the temple's court of women were lit up. And it's reported that there was enough light from these lamps to light up the whole of Jerusalem. It was the Sydney New Year's fireworks of its day. And it's in this context that Jesus says to the people around him, verse 12, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." Once again, as I said 2 weeks ago, these I am statements aren't just random things for Jesus to say. But there's more to it than Jesus making a comment on the lighting of the lamps. If you're a reader of John's Gospel, you should remember the very beginning of the Gospel, or at least whenever you read one of these later chapters, you should remember that you should keep going back to the beginning to see what themes are being picked up. This theme of light is right there, up front. So turn back 7 pages to the very beginning of John's Gospel. Have a look at chapter 1 from verse 4. "In him," Jesus, "was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. There came a man who was sent from God. His name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all men might believe. He himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to every man was coming into the world." From the beginning of John's Gospel, John has identified Jesus for us as the light of mankind, the light that gives light to the world, the light that is life. And now, 7 chapters later, at last, Jesus claims that identity in his own words. But wait, there's more. Come back to chapter 8. Let's look again at verse 12, the whole verse this time. "When Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, 'I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life.' What does Jesus invite his listeners to do with the light? To look at the light? To receive the light? No, he invites them to follow the light. So it's the Feast of Tabernacles, which is one of the festivals celebrating the first Exodus, and Jesus is talking about following a light that gives life. So you should be thinking, was there anything about following a light back in the time of the first Exodus? Yes, there was. You can look up Exodus chapter 13 later. I'll read out for now a couple of verses that describe how God led the people of Israel towards the Red Sea. And this is Exodus chapter 13, verses 21 and 22. "By day the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light so that they could travel by day or night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people." So the pillar of fire back in the time of the Exodus was a light to guide the people. It was the very presence of God with his people that protected them from harm on their journey to the promised land. Here in John chapter 8, Jesus calls himself the light of the world and invites people to follow him. This is nothing less than a claim to be the very presence of God, come to lead his people in the second Exodus into life in the promised land. Those who follow Jesus will have life forever in the kingdom of light. Like Father, like Son. The path to life that Jesus leads his people on goes via the cross. So the question you need to ask yourself is, are you willing to follow Jesus on this path? Not all of Jesus' hearers wanted to follow him. Jesus' statement here that he is the light of the world is immediately followed by a challenge. You have to decide if Jesus is the presence of God, come to lead his people and to guard them safely to life in the world to come. Second aspect of the family likeness I want to look at is shown a bit later on in the chapter. After Jesus' statement in verse 12, there's a controversy with the Pharisees about the validity of Jesus' testimony. That's a variation of an earlier controversy in chapter 5, and Jesus argues here that his testimony is valid precisely because of his relationship with his Father. Specifically, that he speaks what his Father has taught him to speak. Like Father, like Son. But I'm going to skip the details of that, pick up the account from verse 30. It seems that despite this controversy, some people do show some sort of faith in Jesus. And so, as in previous chapters, Jesus goes on to spell out in more detail what that faith will look like. He ups the ante to see whether they are really prepared to follow him. So pick up the narrative over the page from verse 30. Even as he spoke, many put their faith in him. To the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, "If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." I find much of the Bible profoundly moving, such as all of John's Gospel. And yet, sprinkled throughout the Bible, here and there are individual statements of such extraordinary power and significance that they pierce deep into the soul, to the very core of one's being. Now, actually, the whole of John chapter 9 is like that for me, so it's probably a good thing that I'm not going to be speaking on it next week. But chapter 8, verse 32, it chokes me up. Truly, words cannot express what these words do to me. Truly, these words have changed the world. They have been the anthem of countless individuals and movements throughout the last 2,000 years. The desire to be free is one of our greatest human instincts, and yet, at every time and in every place, there have been impediments to freedom. One of the most famous assertions of freedom is in the United States Declaration of Independence, passed by Congress in 1776. It says this: "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are..." Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But this was a sham. Please study the history of slavery in the United States. The Thomas Jefferson who wrote those words was a slave owner. A civil war was fought over slavery. Today, slavery is illegal, but it's not over. There is human trafficking. There are child soldiers. One estimate, the Global Slavery Index, puts the number of slaves today at over 35 million, of which 3,000 are in Australia. That estimate is controversial. But to me, it would still be an outrage, even if it were out by a factor of 10 or more. That's just slavery. You don't have to be a slave to consider yourself not to be free. There are people who are in prison, rightly or wrongly. They are not free. There are people the world over who consider themselves, with some justification, to be trapped by the political or economic systems that govern their lives. What do Jesus' words have to say into this context? More specifically, can we say from history that Jesus' words have had any effect? The evidence is hard to evaluate. The main problem is that human beings are involved. And whenever human beings are involved, there are always a variety of motivating factors that come into play. And it's hard to disentangle them to work out whether some particular aspect of progress was the consequence of the gospel. Nevertheless, the gospel of Jesus has transformed the world. Despite what some would claim, I think a case can be made that Christians and Christianity were instrumental in the abolition of the slave trade, at least as a matter of law. Christians have been at the forefront of reforms to the prison system. But the world's problems are still not solved by any means. The Bible doesn't promise that the world's problems will all be solved in this age. Indeed, in Romans 8, we studied a few years ago, we're told that the world itself still groans, longing for its freedom, and it will continue to groan until the end. Well, what happened just now? I got a bit excited, didn't I? About John chapter 8, verse 32. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. You know what? I ripped it right out of its context in John chapter 8. And what happens when you do that? You very easily and very naturally get emotional, and you make the text mean what you want it to mean, rather than what it actually does mean. So I've talked about freedom in the sense of the liberties we're accustomed to. We naturally understand the word freedom in those terms. And you know what? Jesus' own hearers had an understanding of their own freedom, and it's different from ours. Look at verse 33. They answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been slaves of anyone. How can you say that we shall be set free?" They are not stupid. They are Jews. They do know their own nation's history. They haven't suddenly forgotten that the Feast of Tabernacles that they're currently at is a commemoration of the Exodus, which was the nation of Israel's escape from slavery in Egypt. They haven't forgotten the exile into Babylon. They haven't forgotten their present domination by the Roman Empire. No, they nevertheless regard themselves as always having been free. And their freedom has its basis in their descent from Abraham. Whatever they might have done wrong, their descent from Abraham covers it. No problem. They considered their status before God assured because they were descended from Abraham. And so what Jesus says to them, they consider simply absurd. They are not denying the political reality on the ground. They are denying that they need to be set free by following Jesus' teachings. At which point, if we haven't already, we need to do a double take. Didn't verse 31 begin with these words? "To the Jews who believed him," Jesus said, ... So do they believe Jesus or not? There are a couple of options for resolving this. Jesus is probably speaking to a large group of people, of whom some have genuinely put their trust in Jesus. And then the response that comes back in verse 33 and again later is from the others in the group who haven't. Or it could be that we're seeing here another example of what we saw in chapter 6 when we saw how the faith of some people is fickle. They're initially attracted to Jesus, but when he ramps up his teaching to the next level, they can't hack it. And they turn their back on him. Either way, the people who are responding to Jesus here in verse 33 are those who are opposing him. And at the end of the chapter, they will seek to kill him. But Jesus does answer their question. And as he does, he shows up how they've misunderstood him in two ways. One, the nature of their slavery, and also the nature of the corresponding freedom. And two, the nature of their relationship with Abraham. Verse 34. Jesus replied, "I tell you the truth. Everyone who sins is a slave to sin. Now a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever. So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed." For Jesus, there is a form of slavery that is universal. That slavery is not a political or an economic form of slavery. It makes no difference whether you're a descendant of Abraham or not. Abraham cannot help you out of this form of slavery. This slavery is a slavery to sin. Jesus tells his hearers something truly unpalatable, that is also unpalatable to modern ears. Sin enslaves. It is not a bit of fun that you can take or leave as you please. As a slave to sin, you cannot even run away from your slavery because it is within you. To believe that you can, of your own will, escape your slavery to sin is a delusion. a delusion that will kill you if nothing is done about it, because the slavery of sin is a form of slavery that cuts us off from our Creator God. Because we are by nature, all of us, slaves to sin, we need a Redeemer, someone who will free us from our slavery. And the good news, the great news, is that there is one. To all slaves to sin, Jesus offers release. He offers a restored relationship with God and a secure place in God's kingdom. And on what basis does Jesus make this offer? On the basis that he is the Son of God. Look at verses 35 and 36 again. Now a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever. So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. Jesus is himself the Son he's talking about in these verses. And he's appealing to his hearers' knowledge of A, the forgiveness of sin, and B, the law of slavery. First, only God can forgive sin, because sin is against God. Second, if you are in a household with slaves, only the members of the family can formally release a slave from their slavery. In particular, no one who is also a slave can set free another slave. So what Jesus is saying in these two verses is this: he uniquely is not a slave to sin as they are. Rather, he is the Son of God. And because he is the Son of God, he has the full rights of God. He has the right to forgive sin. And as the Son, a member of the household, he has the right to set slaves free. And if he sets you free, you truly are free. There is no one who can challenge the certificate of release. So, in our salvation, one can also say, like Father, like Son. I need to come back briefly to the relationship between slavery to sin and the other types of slavery I discussed earlier. In claiming that Jesus is here speaking only about slavery to sin, have I just emptied these verses of any power to change the world here and now? If anyone actually suggested that to me, I'd say, have you never heard a Christian testimony? Have you never heard how faith in Jesus has utterly transformed someone's life? And if you think the biggest problem in the world today is capitalism or socialism or global warming, well, whatever it is, Jesus begs to differ. The problem is slavery to sin. Does that mean that everything else is irrelevant, that the gospel has nothing else to say? Well, no. Come back to this text again, verses 31 and 32. To the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, "If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." What is the nature of true freedom? It is a freedom from and a freedom to. It is a freedom from sin. It is a freedom to follow Jesus as his disciple. Jesus says to those who would be his disciples, "Hold to my teaching." The mark of a true disciple is that they remain or abide in Jesus' word. What does that mean? We've already seen the distinction that John draws between those who are true followers of Jesus and those who are not. His true followers are not fickle. They don't only like Jesus when he says something convenient for them. They're willing to listen to him when he says something inconvenient for them, when he says something that confronts and challenges their core beliefs, when he confronts their attitudes, lifestyle, preferences. A true follower is convinced of Jesus' identity as the Son of God. To remain in Jesus' word is to be free. But the freedom Jesus offers is not a freedom to do as one pleases. If Jesus has freed you, you now belong to him. Jesus frees you so that you can now follow him, and that is true freedom. As the song we sung said, "It's only in your will that I am free." If you are free from slavery to sin, you are now also free to be God's agents in transforming the world. You will confront slavery in all its forms. You will confront corruption. You will speak up for and defend the powerless. But never forget that you do these things from your position of freedom. Freedom from slavery to sin. Never forget that that is the greatest type of freedom the world needs. It would be the greatest travesty of Christianity, a betrayal of Jesus, to offer the world freedom from every single one of its woes apart from its slavery to sin, or to deny or even merely to play down the significance of that problem. This would be the natural point for me to stop, but John doesn't stop here. The narrative continues. Jesus' confrontation with his opponents doesn't end here with polite handshakes. It's just getting started. I'll summarize. The issue of being a descendant of Abraham is still in play. Jesus claims that if they want to claim Abraham's heritage, they have to act like Abraham, but instead they're plotting to kill Jesus. Like Jesus, they do what their father does, but their father is not Abraham. Instead, Jesus tells them the result of a spiritual paternity test. Verse 44 is one of the most shocking verses in the whole Bible. You belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desire. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies. Jesus says to his opponents, like father, like son, and because your father is the devil, you do what the devil does. The devil is a murderer and a liar. That's a reference to Genesis chapter 3, where the devil brings about the death of Adam and Eve by telling the very first lie. And now, in the same way, Jesus' opponents want to murder him. If you have any sensitivity at all to the last 2,000 years of world history, you will understand why it's very important that I now clarify what is happening. Jesus is Jewish. Jesus' personal ministry is almost entirely to Jewish people. All of his inner circle of disciples are Jewish. He has quite a few Jewish followers, some of whom, like Nicodemus, have a position of leadership. But Jesus has some opponents who are Jewish, and of those, some of them want to kill him. And it is to those people, and only those, that Jesus directs these words. Well, after saying that, the conversation can't possibly end well. It's actually somewhat surprising that the conversation keeps going after that. But it does. But again, I'll skip most of it and jump to the end. Another famous verse, verse 58. I tell you the truth, Jesus answered, before Abraham was born, I am. This is now Jesus' claim to be the one identified for us by John in the very first verse of his gospel. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. This time when Jesus says, I am, he's invoking God's own name as revealed to Moses at the site of the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3. And they knew it. And because Jesus' opponents don't believe that he's equal with God, they consider this to be blasphemy, and they pick up stones in order to stone Jesus, thus confirming Jesus' accusation against them that they're trying to kill him. This too is an instance of like father, like son, because when God revealed his name to Moses, he did so in the context of assuring Moses that he had heard the cry of his people in their afflictions, that he promised to rescue them out of their slavery and to bring them into the land of Canaan. So here, in revealing his unity with this God of Moses, Jesus promises to bring about a second Exodus, greater than the first, with people drawn from all nations of the earth, and to lead his people into the promised kingdom to be with him forever. as with the end of chapter 6, the end of chapter 8 is a decision point for everyone who reads this gospel. To anyone who is considering becoming a disciple, Jesus asks them to count the cost and not then to be fickle in their devotion to Jesus. First, in acknowledging one's slavery to sin. And second, to remain in Jesus' word, that is, to allow it to transform every aspect of one's life. Jesus' opponents denied their slavery to sin. They couldn't accept that they had a problem and that Jesus could have any part in solving it. Next week in chapter 9, the conflict continues and the language of light and darkness is transformed into the language of sight and blindness. It is one of the greatest, most profound chapters in the Bible. Do not miss it. Will you pray with me? Our Father, thank you again for John's gospel. Thank you for telling us so clearly about Jesus, that he himself is the light of the world, that if we remain in him as his disciples, we will know the truth, and we will be truly set free from the power of sin. Thank you that in seeing Jesus, we see you, the one who sent him. Help us each day to keep following Jesus, to remain in his word, to live out our freedom in obedience and devotion. And we ask for Jesus' sake. Amen.